From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Figuring out how to summarize the work Francine DeCourcy has done in the North Carolina film world is, well, complicated. It can't be confined to a title, but filmmaker activist gets closer to an accurate description than anything else. Filmmaker, referring to the multiple roles she's played, producer, writer, director, editor, and that's not an exhaustive list. Activist, relating to the kinds of films she's chosen to write, direct, and produce. But her activism goes even deeper. Her company, On Location Production Services, has provided locations, extras, crew members, and other support services for over 100 feature film and television productions, including Bolden, Freedom Song, Dawson's Creek, Twilight Zone, Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored, Touched by an Angel, and Black Dog. Francine DeCourcy grew up in Charleston, South Carolina, during the era of legal racial segregation. A young white girl living near a largely black community in the segregated American South, she grew to know and love Gullah Geechee culture. And she met Dixie Lee, her childhood best friend. It was here she also received an early and direct education about the cruelty and the harm of racism. She joins me now. Francine DeCourcy, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, WHQR, for hosting this.
And just a quick note, there is a free screening courtesy of the North Carolina Filmmakers Series of Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored. The showing is Sunday, February 13th, 2022 at 4 p.m. at the Point 14 in Wilmington. Now, Francine DeCourcy, you take the fact that you're white and the featured guest for this film, Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored, very seriously. The film tells the story of a boy, an African-American boy who grows up in Mississippi, a rural, southern, poor community, and how a white supremacist American culture affected him and his family. Why are you sensitive about your own race in the discussion of this film?
Well, as you mentioned, Rachel, I'm a child of the South. I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina. I'm on my meemaw and granddaddy's farm, which was right next door to a beautiful Gullah Geechee community. Mama Lee owned a little diner, barbecue diner, right next door. And she was way ahead of her time. She had built a whole row of cottages for her family. And I would often hear their sing-song languages and their laughter. And it always drew my attention. So I soon got to be attracted to that. And her goddaughter, Dixie Lee Baker, became my best friend at age 6 years old. She would come over and we would play jumps, rope, and hopscotch, and we would laugh till our sides hurt. And we were just best friends. I was probably 6 or 7. She was a beautiful little light brown skinned girl, very smart and very feisty. And so our family had been very embracing of Mama Lee's family. In fact, our Mama Lee's children had gone to my mother and my aunt's weddings, unheard of in the South. In the 1950s. So they weren't prejudiced and racist. So we got the benefit of that. But by the time we separated and went to different schools, I started seeing the vestiges of racism. I'll never forget one afternoon, a little white girl who was one of my classmates came over to play. And Dixie Lee came home from her school and came running over and hugged me as she always did. And I'll never forget this. That little white girl said, "Why are you letting that N-word hug you?" I saw my friend Dixie Lee's face fall. It hurt my soul to this very day. And I think I told that little white girl, "Get out of my yard and never come back." I really think my activist soul was born that day.
How old were you at that point?
Probably 6 or 7.
Yeah. So
now, I didn't understand the impact then, but I just knew that when I saw Dixie Lee being pain-filled, something was wrong.
Yeah. Did you understood what that word meant, though, at the time?
Yes.
Was it something that was ever used in your household growing up?
No. my grandmother, my grandfather, my cousins, my aunts, uncles were all, like I said, had embraced Mama Lee's whole family. And so I considered them adopted family. So
this film, Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored, as I said, it's the story of a boy, of an African-American boy growing up in this rural, southern, very poor community. And at this point, when you were hired to provide people for the film, and you were providing background actors, and you also had to find some very specific types, you had already worked on a number of films that were largely about an African-American story, the African-American community. What were some of those other films?
Simple Justice, To Dance with Olivia, Ditch Digger's Daughters, Freedom Song. Let me digress just a bit, because a key part here. When I moved to Wilmington to break into the film industry, I got involved with a Big Buddy program. So it became a continuation of my relationship with Dixie Lee, even though it wasn't her. I took on a young family as a big buddy. There were 8 children in the family, and I became their big buddy. Big Buddy said I had to be involved with them for them for a year. I've been with them for 36 years. So they became my family. Their grandchildren and children are my family. So the saga has continued. So back to your question.
And so I just want to be clear, when you got involved with the Big Buddy program, the kids that you took on, you initially took on just one.
Right.
And wound up taking on all the siblings as well. Since we're going there, let's talk about that. Let's talk about what this was like. And these were children of color.
They were ebony skin children of color. And the I got involved with Stacy, one of the twins, and her twin sister, Tracy. And then it got to be where every time I would go pick Stacy up, she would have bragged to her sisters about how much fun we were having. And so next time I'd go to pick them up, there'd be 5 little black girls sitting on the curb. And it got to be easier to take them with me than leave them on the curb crying. So they became my family. And I got them involved in everything I did, in my movies, in my fundraising work, in my community events. So by the time they were 14, they had impressive resumes. So,
and what kinds of things were they doing in the movies that you were working on?
Oh, I'd have them be extras in the movies. I'd have them be, when I was working on an event, I would have them be my publicity team. They'd put up posters. I'd have them come, you know, serve hot apple cider and cookies at events. So they got a real education, and they still to this day credit with me with opening their eyes to another world they've never been exposed to.
And so going back to Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored, what did you actually have to provide for this film? Who were you giving them?
Yes. Well, as you know, every department on a film set brings their unique skills and experience to the art of storytelling. You know, the camera department, the lighting department, et cetera. And so, but extras casting is the only one that deals with people and their schedules, their personalities, all of that. And so I had to populate each scene with a realistic group of people, because the actors need to walk onto a set and have a believable group of people that make them realize that they are in an authentic setting. And so that was my job, to make sure those scenes were populated with the right kind of people. So fortunately, because of my connection to the Black community, I had an arsenal of people. So I was able to connect with, you know, the beautiful community that we had to build, the church group, the gospel choir, all of that became people I knew I could easily call. So my partner at the time, and Emily Young, she and I got to where we would recognize people who come onto the set and light up with the interest in film. So we made it our mission to help them to get connected to a mentor so they could make a living in the business. I have a ton of young people who have grown up in the business that we have helped facilitate their career.
Now, as a white casting director, extras casting director, it would have been unusual for you to have a connection with the Black community in the 80s and 90s in Wilmington. Why is that? What was the atmosphere in Wilmington at the time?
Well, as you know, Wilmington has a tragic racial history. From 1898, we separated, the massacre and coup d'etat separated the races along racial lines. And so there was a lot of distrust and a lot of uncertainty when a white person came into their community. But because the Black community had started seeing me with my girls, and not just for a day, but for years, I gained a level of trust and an insight that most white middle-class women don't have. So I was honored to be put in that position.
So you really had and have this sensitivity towards issues that affect people of color, and a sensitivity also towards this kind of overarching white supremacist attitude and kind of institutional structure. Right. That affects people. And you had a sensitivity to that before everybody was talking about it. And by that, I mean the white community starting to tune into that.
Right.
So you're working on Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored, and there is a very specific location that you need to find.
Yes.
And you're going to tell us. Actually, yeah. You're going to tell us about that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. Filmmaker and activist Francine DeCourcy is my guest today. After this short break, we'll also find out how she landed in Wilmington in the first place and why she stayed. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Francine DeCourcy is a filmmaker, writer, director, and runs a company that provides a range of location services to feature films and television productions. The 1996 film, Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored, shot in North Carolina, was one of many feature films for which she's provided local actors. Today, we're learning how she turned her film work into activism around racial justice and reconciliation. And just a quick note, you can catch a free screening of Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored this Sunday, February 13th, 2022, at 4 p.m. at the Point 14 in Wilmington, courtesy of the North Carolina Filmmaker Series. Francine, just before we went to break, you were going to tell us about this one particular location for this film that presented not really a small challenge in terms of finding it. What was this? What did you need to find?
Well, the cotton fields played a significant role in this movie. My On Location Production Services partner, Jim Herring, was a location manager on this film. And they were not able to find a cotton field. First of all, it was out of season. So he was all over trying to find one. And they were about to move the film to Mississippi or Georgia or somewhere. And so Jim came in one day with a sock with just a touch of cotton on it saying, "We got cotton." And Tim Reed danced a jig and said, "Okay." But then he said, "Wait a minute, there's no cotton on these stalks." So they got together a group of migrant farm workers and hot glued and stapled cotton onto all these stalks. The migrant farm workers said, "We take it off. We know put it on." "Well, you're putting it on this time." And so they were able to create this believable world of this cotton field because it's the opening scene in the movie. And the little boy, Cliff, was born in the field that day. And so part of my casting responsibility was to find an infant that looks like he's just being born, but they have to be at least 6 weeks old, but they have to be believable as an infant. And so we've looked all over and we finally found one. And the other added part of this was he had to be bald because his grandfather needed to fall in love with him. And his grandfather, played amazingly by Al Freeman Jr., was bald. So those two pieces were very important. And then we had to shoot this, I think, about 2 hours away. So we had to find extras with people we didn't know and populate that entire cotton field. Fortunately, I had a select group of really tight-knit folks that said, we're coming anyway. So I brought a wonderful group of core extras and then filled it up with some of the people around that community.
How many extras did you have to cast for this film?
No, I can't remember because it's been so long ago, but generally this one was not as extra heavy because it was a tight-knit community where you saw the same people over and over. But it was important to me to make sure that I was able to represent the breadth of diversity within the Black community, from their skin tone to their beautiful seasoned weathered faces, you know, the churchgoers and the barbecue folks, the folks that were the best friends of the grandpa sitting on the barbershop steps. So all of that was very important to make sure that we found that diversity of talent.
Going back to the baby, so you had to find a baby that was bald and that looked like a newborn, but wasn't actually a newborn, because you wouldn't put a newborn on a film set. So how the heck did you find this baby? How did you do it?
It was, you know, my partner and I we contacted all the hospitals, obstetric units, all the obstetricians, all of our Black community to say, if you got a baby coming, let us know so that we can make sure that we get them in. And so it was an all out effort, but you know, that's standard in the film business. You know, there's always something that you need to find that seems impossible, but that's the magic of making movies. We managed to pull it out and make it happen. So we found this beautiful little boy, Montel Johnson, and his mom, and they drove 2 hours away and we put them in a trailer and took care of them all day. So yeah, it was a masterpiece, you know?
Yeah. And so in this film, again, mid 20th century, when segregation was legal and considered normal, one of the messages of the film, we just see how these racist white people and the white supremacist values of the majority affect the boy's great-grandfather. So the boy's the protagonist. We see him growing up, and we see how this patriarch, this incredible great-grandfather, has to educate his great-grandson about the white rules without crushing the boy's spirit.
Right.
And one of these kind of, I guess, iconic moments in the film is during a parade, which you also had to cast. Can you just talk about that scene and what happens in the scene?
Yes. This was the KKK parade marching down the street. And we didn't have people from the KKK in our arsenal of archives. So we called all of our white extras men and said, would you do this? And most of them said no, because they were all good guys. So we made a deal with them and said, okay, at the end of the movie, it says Hoochie Goochie girly show. So if you come and wear the robes, you won't be seen. So then we can put you in the Hoochie Goochie scene. And so that worked. But what I know, really, you gotta be creative, right? So what was really haunting was my partner said that the chief of police in the town where we were shooting this said, oh, I didn't know you were doing a KKK scene. We could have brought all of our people who are KKK and they could have brought their own sheets.
Wow.
Let that sit with you for a minute.
Wow. You know, there are some extras in that scene that are very recognizable. Did some people eventually just say, I'm willing to do this to tell the story, or what what happened?
The ones that actually got recognized were the actors that got cast with speaking lines, and so a little bit of a different thing. It was a hard scene because, as you recall, and I don't want to give it away to the people who haven't seen it yet, but there's a moment where the KKK comes up and confronts the grandfather, and his dignity and strength and resilience showed on his face when he had to squeeze the ice cream cone he had just bought for his beautiful grandson so that he wouldn't react and put him and his grandson in harm's way. It was a powerful scene.
It is. There's also a scene when he very elegantly explains to his grandson, his great-grandson, how to read the first letter of a word, how to recognize a C and how to recognize a W. And there's so much restraint that the character exhibits in that scene as well, because none of the baggage of that seems to come through. It's like he's just teaching this young boy how to read. Can you explain how that unfolds?
Well, yes. You know, we had this beautiful, tight-knit community of African-Americans that took care of each other, that loved each other. You can feel the closeness and the love in that community. But the minute you cross the railroad tracks, you're going into white territory. And so even going to a service station, you know, or even going into town, you know, you're in harm's way. And so the little boy has to go to the bathroom. And so his grandpa pulls over to a service station, and the little boy jumps out and runs to the restroom, and the service station attendant says, "Wait a minute, don't you dare. You know better than that." And so it had a sign on the restroom saying white. And he said, "Didn't you see that sign?" He said, "Grandpa, I can't read." And so the grandfather had to teach him what a W looked like for white and what a C looked like for colored, so he can watch for both of those in water fountains, restrooms, wherever he was going. And you're right, you could feel the restraint and the pain of having that be one of the first lessons that your young grandson is learning because of this brutality and injustice of separating people on the basis of the color of their skin.
Yeah. So in this film, there's also a scene in a juke joint.
Yes, yes.
And you've said to me in an earlier conversation that the shooting of this scene was your favorite day on a film set ever.
Yes.
Why was that? Tell us about that day.
Well, I'm a huge blues fan anyway. So originally this was a scene with a band of 11 players. So when I found out I had to cast this band and all the people in the juke joint and all of the bartenders and dancers and all that stuff, I was like, yay. And so we put out a call all over the Southeast for people of color, musicians, blues players. And at the time Ice House was open. And so we had the courtyard of the Ice House. And so we had just tons of beautiful performing artists coming and all rehearsing. And so they would play their music. And, oh my God, be still my heart. And so I was just over the moon being in this situation. But then in the middle of the casting, I get a call from Tim Reed's wife. Tim Reed was the director, from his wife, Daphne, saying, "Well, we don't need 11 players now. We lost that location. We only need 4. And I was like, so I've already fallen in love with all of these people. So I got together with my partner and said, "You know what? Let's just have them all come. If they're not in the band, they'll be in the juke joint, they'll be at the bar, they'll be one of the dancers." So they all showed up, and it was just magic. Well, Taj Mahal, one of my all-time favorites, was the leader of this band, and we cast Charlie Lucas, rest in peace, one of our favorite blues musicians here in town. And so when we got to the set, while everybody was going through period hair, makeup, and wardrobe, Taj Mahal was in his trailer. Well, Charlie Lucas said, "Go get me that guitar so I can practice before the scene." And so I did. Well, all of a sudden, he starts jamming, and his son plays percussion. So he starts jamming on the, you know, with a clothes hanger on the metal chairs. And then all these people who are players start singing And a jam session broke out like you'd never heard before. It was magic. Taj Mahal heard it, came out of his trailer, plopped down, and didn't leave for the rest of the day. And every time they would try to come get us to come to set, Taj said, I never get to do this. I'm not leaving. So we ended up going a day over schedule because nobody would leave the scene. It was pure magic. So I'll never forget that. Some of our local folks, you know, Tim Kennedy and Larry Price and Darren Beatty and a lot of folks from the Black Arts Alliance were all in attendance and performers. So that was incredible. And so then when we actually premiered the film, I managed to get Tim Reed to let us premiere it at Salient Hall. And so we brought in Taj Mahal and Al Freeman Jr. And both of them said, don't you dare tell our agents we're doing this for free and come in on our own dime, but we will be there. And so they showed up. So we recreated that jam session in City Hall chambers. And I had them met by a 40-voice black gospel choir on the steps of Thalian Hall. And Al Freeman came because his best friend, Pat Hingle, lived here. And so when I told him Pat Hingle was here, he said, what? And so I used that as a hook to get them. So between the casting of the film, the scene itself, and the after party was continued magic. And I'll never forget it because it just resides in my heart as one of the all-time favorite moments on a film set.
And you can catch a free screening of Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored this Sunday, February 13th, 2022, at 4 p.m. at the Point 14 in Wilmington. You're listening to Coastline. Francine DeCourcy is a filmmaker, activist, and provides location services for films. She's written and produced documentaries about Wilmington's 1898 coup d'etat and the Wilmington 10. She's also provided background actors, crew, and location services to over 100 feature film and television productions, including Bolden, Freedom Song, Dawson's Creek, Twilight Zone, Touched by an Angel, and of course, Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored. And Francine DeCourcy, one of the things you told me about casting background actors for film is, especially in the heyday of this, you met every single potential background actor in person.
Yes.
How did you do that? And why was it important to you to meet them in person?
Well, back in the day before, you know, the internet, this was back before the internet or before, you know, any of that kind of electronic stuff, we would hold a casting call at like the Martin Luther King Center and have everybody come and show up. And so that way we got to meet them. We got to test their attitude because, you know, don't forget now, we have to make sure these people fit in the wardrobe. So everybody had to be under a size 12, had to make sure they had the right hair that could be, you know, adjusted for the period. They couldn't have long fingernails, like things that are, you know, germane to the scene. But also it was important for us to be able to sense out who's coming. And like I said before, it became part of my mission to open the doors for people of color to get an opportunity to work in the business. So just by meeting them in person, looking in their eyes, hearing why they were interested in doing this, gave us a heads up as to who might be our key people. And so yeah, now they can send it something online and get a casting call notice on the internet. Not in our day, but I'm glad we were doing it back in the day because it made a huge difference.
Now, you actually intended to come to Wilmington as a way of getting a few credits, a few film credits under your belt. You knew that you wanted to work in the film industry, but you weren't exactly sure how, in what capacity. And so you were going to get a few film credits under your belt and for a year, maybe two. And then you were going to go to LA. And that was more than 35 years ago. So what happened? How did you land in the port city, first of all? Why here?
Well, trying to condense my background, I started off as a model. And then I started producing fashion shows for television. So I started getting interest in behind the scenes. And so when the film industry was born here, I had been traveling all over and I had ended up in California. And my sister and her beloved family, her husband and her four children, were there. And so when I came here, I had a hole in my heart the size of my family. So that was what drew me to the Big Buddy program, actually. But I ended up needing to find a way to express myself. So the African-American films became an entree. But I soon found out about the negative racial history of 1898, the Wilmington Tea Party.
How did you find out about that? Do you remember your first kind of like, yes. Whoa, yeah. That happened?
Absolutely. Well, ironically, when I got to be a Big Buddy, I wanted to make sure I was doing things right. So I reached out to a few people that had become friends of mine, Rhonda Bellamy, Lloyd Wilson, Joe Wright, who was one of the Wilmington 10, and they schooled me. And anytime I'd have a question about make sure I was doing something right, they would let me know. So Joe Wright, one of the 10, told me what had happened with 1898 and with the Wilmington 10. So we were actually in development on a documentary about both of those when he died of an illness he contracted while he was unjustly accused and incarcerated for the what happened with the Wilmington 10. So then that became a mission. So I became one of the founding members of the 1898 Centennial Foundation. I spent 8 years documenting that work called Remembering 1898, Moving Forward Together. And it aired on PBS several times. And then Willie Vereen and Connie Tindall, two of the Wilmington 10, begged me to tell their story. But back in the day of film, that was cost prohibitive. So we figured out a way eventually to tell their story. We never got it quite finished, but we at least have a standalone of 25 minutes, which we've taken into the school system and informed the next generation about what happened in their community. So as a result, my activist, career was really launched, and I continued to stand up and testify, if you will, because it's been a saga in our community and across the country and the world.
You're listening to Coastline. I'm talking with filmmaker and activist Francine DeCourcy about her work in Wilmington's film industry for more than 35 years. When we come back from this short break, we continue our exploration. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Francine DeCourcy knew she wanted to be involved in the film world when she was in college. She just wasn't sure in what capacity. She came to Wilmington, North Carolina in 1985 and soon found herself providing extras, background actors, to feature film productions. Later, when she started learning about Wilmington's racial history and the reasons for its embedded racial divide, she turned to making documentaries about the 1898 coup d'etat and about the Wilmington 10. And Francine, just before we went to break, you were talking about how you would bring these documentaries into classes in the school system. What was that like? What do you remember about how the students received the information, how they reacted to learning about this?
Absolutely. Well, both 1898 and the Wilmington 10 have been well-kept secrets to a great extent, especially 1898. And a little quick backstory for people who don't know, in the 33 years after the Civil War, Wilmington had emerged as a mecca for African-Americans. There was a wonderful community of progressives who were building their own businesses and such. Well, the white power elite didn't like that and totally staged the only coup d'etat in our nation's history and removed the white elected government from power and replaced them with themselves and staged a white person's declaration of independence saying black people were not suitable for high paying jobs or elected office. So that's the context under which, this happened. And so then the Wilmington 10, when it came along, they had heard that history whispered in their families and they wanted to tell that story, but they had no way of doing it. And so when I met Connie Tindall and Willie Vereen when I was working on one of my first films, Weeds, and they both pursued me ardently to say, help us. And so it wasn't until years later when there was more cost-efficient equipment that I was able to start doing that. So we put together with no money, a 25-minute piece. And I contacted some of the people that were teachers in middle school, because that's where they learn, you know, North Carolina history. And I got a copy of this to them, and they would stage a town hall or a assembly or whatever. We did about, I don't know, maybe 15 like that. And I would take, send the video. They would, when we got there, they would screen the video. And then I would bring Connie Tindall and Willie Vereen, two of the original 10, into that setting. It was powerful. It was incredibly powerful, because most of them had never heard of this. And so to hear that here's a group of people, this was, you know, don't forget, this was during the days of segregation when they decided to integrate the Black schools, and so they closed the only Black school, the Williston, which was known by the Black community as the greatest school under the sun. And they closed it without any forewarning and put all of those students into white schools. Nobody prepared anybody for it. So there was unrest and hostility at every turn. So everybody was hurt and angry. And so I was honored that these two guys trusted me with their story. And so I wasn't telling the story, though I was putting a camera in front of them to tell their story. So it was amazing to see that the response, because all these young men did was stand up for their rights. And eventually they staged a boycott. They all moved into the Gregory Congregational Church that was run by a white preacher. And they ended up having continuing education, but then the white power elite, the KKK, started driving by and shooting at the church. And eventually 10 people were accused unjustly of being the perpetrators of this. And they ended up being incarcerated for a combined total of 282 years in federal prison for something they did not do. So imagine you're a young man getting ready to go off to seek your fortune or go to college, and now you're being thrown into prison because the white power elite doesn't like that you had the audacity, the unmitigated gall, to stand up as a man and speak out for what you believed in.
Did you get any, you said that you would show this material to teachers, and they would have a school assembly or a town hall or some kind of big gathering where they could show the film, and you would bring Connie Tindall or Ben Vereen, two of the Wilmington 10. Willie Vereen, yes, thank you. And they would talk about it. Did you ever get any pushback on that front? Because this would have been in the 90s?
Yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, go ahead.
As a matter of fact, I did. I would get calls from both sides. From the white community, I got death threats saying, how dare you tell this story? And from the Black community even, I would get people saying, how dare you tell our story? And I was like, I'm not telling your story. I'm putting a camera in front of the men who lived it. And by the way, by this time, it was 40 years later. And so I said, you have ample time to tell it. And I said, but meanwhile, these two men have continued to pursue me to tell their story. So I will stand up for injustice anywhere I see it. And if I can make a difference at all, I will. So that's become, I saw the power of media for social change, and it became my life's work. And so that's why we're here today. I'm continuing that saga in hopes that it's made a bit of a difference. I'm hoping that everybody, when they watch this film, that they will put themselves in the shoes of these beautiful people of color and imagine what it must have been like to have to just really tone down your personality, your beliefs, your way of being in the world for fear of death.
Yeah. So you also did a documentary about the coup d'etat of 1898, and you just explained that there was this thriving Black professional class, and there was certainly an integrated government, and there, with the thriving professional class, came wealth and power, which the white power structure decided they weren't comfortable with. So they ousted people from government. They drove people out of the city. And Wilmington has never, at least from what I understand, appeared to be integrated in any real way since. That divide remains. But you said when you started working on that documentary, being one of the founding members of the Centennial Foundation, there wasn't a lot of support for this work and there wasn't a lot of material. So how did you find your way? What did you find to put together that story on film?
Well, originally I was going to do a documentary on what had happened in 1898, but there were very few support materials, very few photographs. And so, but by the time I got immersed in, our mission was to tell the story, to honor the memory, to heal the wounds, and to restore the hope. And I was involved in all those committees. So I was seeing the work of these individuals. And fortunately, there was a plethora of beautiful people, Black and white, who came together. Every committee was equally balanced, Black and white. And so friendships were formed, professional relationships were formed. I still stand by the fact that the 1898 Foundation has done more to bring people together in this community than anything that I've seen before or since. And so we were able to, so as I was paying attention to this, I said, you know what? Here's the story here. Here's a city with a negative racial history trying to do something about it. So I had no financial support. So I would grab every videographer. I'll never forget there was a guy, Eric Peterson, who worked for the TV station. And he was there at our opening ceremony, and I grabbed him up and said, can I have this footage? And ironically, his wife was on the publicity committee. And so he ended up kind of being my go-to videographer, him and a few other folks. And anytime we were doing an event, we would come capture it. So I captured 45 hours of footage over 8 years and documented and logged every bit of it and put together this 45-minute piece that chronicles the work of our mission. To tell the story, honor the memory, heal the wounds, and restore the hope. And so it aired on PBS several times. And ironically, a young white kid from UNCW saw it and contacted me. And he decided he never had heard about it. So he dedicated his college career to learning about it and ended up producing a beautiful piece of work called The Red Cape, which has just recently aired on PBS. And so fortunately, we've been able to spark the interest of a lot of different people. And I feel like we made a difference. We're still a long way off. The struggle continues. But at least we've done what we could, given the time frame and the lack of resources. But the good people that came together that made this happen, I honor, I celebrate, and I am so grateful to be a part of that.
When you think about where the Cape Fear region is now in the 21st century in terms of its racial reconciliation journey, how would you describe the current state and what needs to happen for full healing and reconciliation?
Well, that's a big question. But, you know, the truth is that I felt after the 1898 Centennial Foundation, we were well on our way. But then we start seeing more and more unrest. You know, when the George Floyd happened and all of the murders of young Black men, unjustified, just murder on the street, then it starts trickling down everywhere. And Wilmington became a place of protest, and justifiably so. And so we ended up with a big contingent of people standing up and speaking out. But, you know they're always putting themselves in harm's way because we have this racial history. So I have a great hope for the possibility of people finding a way to connect. Ironically, there's a, talking about the power of media for social change, there's an effort afoot to train the next generation of filmmakers, especially women and people of color. And so the union is heading that up. Susie Hamilton is involved with that. She was with the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. So there's looking like there's going to be some of that. And I've been asked to serve on that committee because I'm one of the ones been advocating for it from the beginning. So I'm hoping that we can teach people to tell their own stories and and have an opportunity to hear from them. You know, I was on the board of the Black Film Festival for 15 years, and I'm now on the board of the Cinema Sisters Film Festival. So I've chosen film as my medium of communication, and hoping that it will, because, you know, let's face it, you know, when you're sitting in a darkened theater, you can have your own thoughts. You can see a perspective that you might not have ever thought of. And so that's what I'm hoping will happen with this Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored, because it's a really beautiful piece. But also all movies that address these issues hopefully will reach into the very marrow of people's hearts and remind them that we are all one race, the human race. And it's going to take all of us to undo the challenges of this world and its continuing problems. We'll be much better off if we can join hands and hearts and minds and become a power force for good. So that's my hope at the conclusion of this film, that people recognize that we are all in this together.
You have championed women in film, and they've been a minority in the industry since, well, for many decades. And you received a Governor's Award for a documentary about the 75th anniversary of the suffrage movement?
Yes, I did. You know, I've been grateful to receive many awards over the years, the Women of Achievement Award, that was the Governor's Award for about minorities and women in the community colleges. So, yeah.
What is it about women's stories that require, I mean, this may seem like an obvious, silly question, but, you know, I don't know that it is, because for a while we had the term chick flick. And personally, that rankles a little bit for me, because I sort of feel like stories about women are stories about humans.
Right.
And you, as you just said, have been championing women in film. Why is it that we need more women in other roles in film? How will that change storytelling about women?
Well, let's face it, the majority of the films are produced by men and directed by men and crewed by men. More and more women are finding their way in. And so I've been on the board of this Women's Film Festival for 7 years now. And so I've been able to watch, like during COVID, I watched 100 movies by women, which was saved my soul. But you see the different approaches to storytelling and the issues and the subtleties that women deal with that men have no knowledge of or no interest in. You know, in those 100 films, I didn't see one drive-by shooting, one special effect, nothing. It's all about heart and women's issues. And so I'm glad that I've been a part of that, and I continue to be. I'm now on the, I've been on the board of the Cape Fear Community College film and video program for years, and they've got an impressive group of people. And I've also worked with the university film studies program. So, you know, there's a lot of avenues to champion, you know, this kind of work. And so, yeah, so women and minorities, and not to discount the men in our world, because, I mean, they're important too. And we have some beautiful men in our film community, and they have supported us over the years. And I celebrate and love them all. But from a perspective of storytelling about issues that affect us as women or as minorities, we need to hear more from the people who have lived it. And so the more we can have women filmmakers, the more we can have people of color as filmmakers, as storytellers, I think the more perspectives we'll have and the better educated we will be, and the more our hearts will be touched.
And that is this edition of Coastline. Francine DeCourcy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks also to the North Carolina Filmmakers Series. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Jonathan Furnell engineered this episode. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. You can find this episode and more information at whqr.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.